Hi Sober Tribe, and welcome to the Sober Gay Socials podcast, where we have honest conversations about addiction and recovery in the gay community. I'm your host Stephen, and this is episode 3. Today's guest is a fairly recent addition to the Sober Gay Socials group, but straight off the bat she was immediately active within the group, wasting no time in organising an online meeting for women only of the group, and then organising a women's only walking event. So here to talk about what sober women really want is Jane Saxton. Welcome to the studio, Jane.
Hi, Stephen. Nice to meet you. Hopefully I don't come across as quite as bossy as that, but
No, of course you don't.
It was so nice to actually be welcomed so much into the group. I felt comfortable straight away. And that's why I felt I could offer something, as I realised there was a lot of women in the group, but not always coming to events. So hopefully we can start a little bit of a community, do a bit more mingling with the men and grow that side of it.
Perfect. That's great. That's exactly what we want with the group as well. Okay, so if you'd like to introduce yourself and tell the listeners a bit about you and your sober journey.
Okay, so my name is Jane. I'm 47, so I spent a lot of my time. I am 47. So I spent a lot of my 20s in the 90s, which obviously heavy drinking rave culture. But just to go a bit back further, I've come from quite a working class background, very hard work ethic. Parents split up when I was 4 years old. Mother remarried, still obviously in contact with my dad at the time. And I went through school. I was okay at school, like a great my qualifications, but I suppose I started experimenting when I was about 14, 15, local park, that kind of
when
drinking.
When you say experimenting?
Kind of, just the odd drink of alcohol, whatever. Anyone could get their hands on, really. The local park.
Was it Bacardi Breezes back in your
it
day?
It wasn't. It was baby sham.
A baby sham. That was my mum's favourite drink, a brandy and baby
anything
sham.
Anything anyone could get their hands on, really. So it wasn't always the best. And then it was obviously Mad Dog 2020, which we all had very dark experiences on, quite strong at the time. But and then when I was 18, I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I just knew I didn't want to just sit in an office all day. I was a bit more excitement. That's how I ended up in casinos for the next 25 years.
Wow, casinos. That must have been hard going, working in casinos, especially with the late hours.
Yeah, late hours, different culture, different work life. As you know, you've worked in bars. You see things that people don't normally see.
Yeah, because it's too drunk to see. That's why. We're stood there like, really?
And you are dealing with the mess of it, but you're also dealing with the upside and the downside of that side of life. But it is a different kind of culture, really. But I enjoyed it. I absolutely loved it. It was exciting. So that's kind of a bit of about my backstory.
Oh, perfect. That's great. So again, we have got a similar background. We both obviously came out in the 90s. We both drank Mad Dog 2020. Yeah. And we both obviously worked in that industry. We were having a chat before we started recording as well. I think sober people that have worked within that industry have a different mentality towards drinks. So for us, when we walk into a bar, we don't go, oh, there's a bottle of vodka and we can make cocktails. Everything's fancy. We look at a bottle of vodka and go, it costs this much.
Yeah, how many units? Yeah.
Perfect. Okay, so when we did first meet at the Sober Sungay lunch, obviously I immediately got the impression that you were a strong, confident and an independent woman. And I wasn't wrong. Inevitably, the conversation then ended up turning around to where are all the women, which often comes up when women attend our events as the group is top heavy with men. So we've had so many great women as well come to these events and then obviously never to be seen again. I raised the question to you, what do sober women want?
When I figure out what women want, I will probably understand what sober women want. I do organise walks in a lesbian and bisexual women's walking group. I've learned a lot from that. And also when I went into a gay running group.
Yeah, because you're a big runner. You've just done it. Was it a marathon?
Or a half marathon. Yeah, I just did one last week. And I enjoy running. But what I noticed is that it becomes quite top heavy with men every time you meet up, and it kind of scares a lot of women away. They see in pictures, if there's one woman there, they go, okay, I can't, because I'm not sure that they can always identify with the men. Men are a lot more confident, as we discussed before. I think growing up men, boys certainly are allowed to just go out and play on the streets to whatever time they want. You know, they can have a little bit of a wilder life, whereas women are like more restricted even growing up. You know, you can't go down a certain road, you can't be out in the dark, you can't do this, you can't do that.
So it's safety in numbers then?
It is safety in numbers, but obviously I never conformed to that, which is why I worked in a casino, I would walk out on the streets. You know, I've always been a confident person and a streetwise person. So that's why I can walk into a group in a room full of men and feel quite comfortable.
But at the same time with that as well, I don't understand why the women didn't come back. We did have a regular woman that came to the group, and she was like, it's fine, but it's if you keep going to an event and you're the only woman there and you sat with a load of men, I know what it'd be like for me. If I was going out to an event and it was just women all the time, you'd quickly get bored with it. And the conversation is obviously completely different. Whereas if we can get this blended group where we've got a good mixture of women and men in the group, I think the conversation is flow a lot easier. People would be a lot more relaxed and more comfortable and confident.
Yeah, I think women do suffer with anxiety a little more in those kind of scenarios, which is why in the walking group, because we're walking together, it's not face on face, it's that they feel a lot more comfortable. And even then, we do always say to them, if you're a little bit nervous, if it's your first time, message me. And even though we had our first coffee and stroll, I actually had people, because I'd put that on, people message me saying, I've never done this before. Yeah. So straight away, it's putting them at ease and just say, look, we're just going to have a little stroll, we're just going to have a little natter. Not a big thing. And we ended up getting on so well.
So just to interject there, just to tell the listeners. So Jane yesterday put on a walking group for women only. Went up to Heaton Park, did a walk around Heaton Park, and then had coffee and cake in the local cafe. And so how many people did you have to turn up for that event?
It was just five of us, but
it was
a nice small group for the first one. To say that we've not had an event on that where five women have turned up, it's the start. It's all how you start. You take one step forward, and this is how it goes. We had a good night, and the women were nervous at first. So I was just to say, look, this is where I am. This is what I'm wearing. You know, you'll be absolutely fine. You know, seasoned pro at these kind of events, you'll be okay. And it's just having a little stroll, asking them about the day and that kind of thing, and making people feel at ease. And before you know it, people become a lot more comfortable. And even one of the ladies said, do you know what? I was even sat in my car, and this is why I was late, because I was thinking, do I really want to do this? And she said, I've had a great day. Yeah. I've absolutely had a great day. So, and we discussed about what kind of things we want to try, whether we want to do a little city centre, little mooch about next time, and just keep changing it up, just trying to get new people into it and build this community. So it was interesting.
Perfect. No, I do really appreciate what you've done as well. And again, just getting that, getting the women only group side of it started up, and getting that blended environment for the bigger scheme of the group.
Yeah, and that is key. We're not doing it just to segregate. It is to build this up. So.
Yes, don't get offended when Jane posts that it's a women-only event. We have had a few of those. We have had a few comments coming through. Why have I been invited to this? Well, you know, I mean, Jane can't sit there and pick through over 300 women.
I think I will have
women.
To next time, yes.
You can't sit and pick through 300 group members to find out which ones are the female, which ones are the males, and so on and so forth. So the invite does go out to everybody. So what we would like is, if you are a male in the group and you do receive this invitation, if you do know of any women that would be interested in coming out on these walks or these events that Jane's putting on, then please pass that over to your female friend so that they can get in touch and get involved. How old were you when you came out?
So
I was straight in there. There's a bit of a deep question. No old bad.
So I kind of have two times for this. The first one is kind of when I fell out. I fell out. She was about 19, 20, which is when I started working in casinos. Before that, I had boyfriends. But it was only then that I just kind of started experimenting and finding out who I was more. And I'm very lucky when I speak to a lot of people that I know, I'm very lucky in the sense that I was always in a working environment where being gay made absolutely no difference. You were not held back for being gay. You're not held back for being a woman. Yeah. And I think that's what probably kept me in casinos for a long time. So I did kind of fall out. I just kind of started seeing a woman that I worked with, and that was that really. But I didn't come out to my mother till I was 29 years old.
Right, okay. And how did that happen?
So it came out by accident, really. It'd been on the tip of my tongue so many times. But I suppose with them being with a Catholic background, I find it quite hard. I didn't think I would be disowned or anything like that. I know a lot of people have been through that struggle, and I knew that wouldn't be me. But you don't want to rock the boat. And I didn't want anybody changing around me. So it was a very strange scenario where my mum was putting clothes in the washing machine after it had just been fixed. And an engineer who she used to know and work with, he actually said to me, I said, "Oh, I remember you when you were a little kid. Are you married? No. You got a boyfriend? No. So you not got a fella? No. What's wrong with you?" And straight away, my mum flew off the handle. I was like, she doesn't want a fella. It's her business. I was like, what's it? I was like, okay. I think this might be my time now.
It's like, here's your in.
This is your in. So the engineer went, and my mum was putting washing in the washing machine. I was like the most nervous. My legs were trembling. And I was just like, just do it. And I was like, "Mum, you know I'm gay, don't you?" Just blurted it out.
Ripped the Band-Aid off.
Yeah, the Band-Aid came off. I thought, it's done. And as, you know, the true Northern woman, she went, "Yeah, of course I do." Carried putting washing in the washing machine. So, and then it was like, so does everyone else know? I was like, "Well, I think they might do. I think we've already kind of guessed." And I was like, "Okay, good. Well, if they don't, can you tell them for me, please? And let me know what you told them, because I've done my business now." So, yeah. And everyone was absolutely fine. They were fantastic.
Wonderful.
More than fantastic. So all that stress and weight on my shoulders was quite unnecessary.
Yeah. Do you think that's had that stress and that pressure had an effect on you and your drinking issues?
Yes, I think so. Because I was being a bit of a binge drinker. I can go several days or even weeks without any drink. But when I do, the stop button doesn't seem to be there, which is why I wanted to change my relationship with alcohol.
So when was your first experience with drugs and alcohol?
I think with alcohol, it's just started in the park, like I said, at a young age. And then as you're in your early 20s and going out all the time, kind of doing what everybody else does. Especially in the rave culture, also with speed and pills, that kind of thing. And I did get into all of that. And that would eventually just started going, you kind of grow out of that phase. Then I kind of got into weed more, which obviously weed, you know, a lot of these don't actually mix with alcohol. So alcohol was less of an issue then.
Yeah.
But then I decided to stop weed because that was becoming a daily thing. For a long time. So then I just, what's the easiest thing to then just go into? And a lot of it is because I wasn't dealing with these issues. I wasn't dealing with emotions. I wasn't dealing with any feelings because I just, in my head, I just didn't know how to process it. It's like I lacked not empathy for others, which I sometimes did. I had no empathy for myself.
Yeah.
So instead of dealing with any of that or actually starting the process, well, I'll just go get a bottle of wine, or I'll go get some beers,
so
or I'll go get
easier.
Something else. Let's just put it under that carpet. I mean, that carpet is piled high with stuff under it.
That wasn't a carpet.
That's not a carpet. It's a very high carpet. Just keep on brushing stuff underneath it. And eventually, as you know, and most people that are drink or look towards something else to satisfy them in those ways, it will break eventually, and you're going to have to deal with it. And it took me quite a few years to finally do it, of having, you know, big blowouts, blackouts, doing stupid things, embarrassing things. And I look back now and I cringe and I think, that's made me who I am today, and I've had to go through that to get where I am today.
Yeah.
So you shouldn't look back at it like that. It's part of your growth. It's part of your journey. Just accept it.
So were you a daily drinker or daily user or anything?
No, I wasn't. When I was smoking weed, I was. But that I think a lot of was around was shift patterns as well, because my shift patterns were all over the place. So you would just get in, have a spliff, just to even try and get to sleep sometimes. But for drinking, no, I wasn't a daily drinker. I couldn't stand the hangover. There's no way I could drink a hangover. My 20s, yes, but after that, no.
At what point was it that you realised that you had an issue with alcohol?
I think probably a few years back, I started realizing if I was buying a bottle of wine, I was always checking the percentage, little habits like that. And I suppose they just start as little issues, but you're thinking...
Do you know what? You just triggered me there. I never realised I did that. Yes.
Yeah. Because a bottle of wine at 9%, well, in my head, what's the point? Because I wasn't, you know, how many times people, I drink it because I like the taste. No. Most of the time,
I was a snob, actually. I was a bit of a snob. So go for like an expensive wine, but you'd have to be a really good percentage on it as well.
Exactly. You're looking for 13, 14%, aren't you?
Yeah.
You know, what's the point of anything less? Because we tell ourselves, I want it for the taste. Oh yeah, it's got these aromas. Yeah. No, you're not. You want to get drunk.
Yeah, and that's why there was the snob side of me, because you think, well, if I'm being a snob, then it really now can't come.
If it's like... £30 a bottle, then you know it's fine. But it started with little things like that, and then I noticed when I'd broken up with a partner and I was back living on my own, how many times I was just drinking on my own. And I realised this was every Saturday night. You know, Friday, I wouldn't necessarily bother on a Friday night because I'm quite a busy, active person. I would just go 100 miles an hour Saturday on my day off. I no longer worked in casino, so I actually had weekends off. And I would do it all just so I could just sit there with my alcohol on a Saturday night and get drunk.
Yeah.
And it kept happening every week. And I just thought, is this the life you really want? Now, I'd looked into it previously. And I knew that I needed to give it whatever it is that I wanted. Even if I stopped alcohol, I probably would have progressed to food. There's always something there to replace it. And I just thought, I need to fix what the problem is. I need to look at why I'm doing this. And I've swapped one thing for another my entire life.
And I did a similar thing. So when I stopped doing coke, it was always already a heavy drinker to start off with, but then the alcohol consumption just rocketed.
It does.
And I was like, look at me, I can stop cocaine.
Because it's easy to cover the alcohol with the other things, because with weed, it doesn't mix. And with harder drugs, it doesn't really take an effect. So once you take all of them away, it's just like, oh, this is a bit.
Yeah, it was convenience as well. It's so much more difficult to go and get a gram of coke than what it is to just nip around the corner to the off license and get a bottle of wine or a bottle of vodka.
Exactly.
Or in my case, both.
Yeah. And obviously, you're just nipping to go and get to the off license. Well, it's the one thing that you actually have to explain to people why you don't do it, because everyone expects you to drink alcohol.
Yeah.
If you just say, oh, I've given up coke, well done. I've given up alcohol. Why? What's wrong with you? Instead of, okay.
Yeah, it's society's... perspective on alcohol consumption and use isn't the same as what it is with drugs.
Yeah. I mean, you look at every birthday christening card, every wedding, every funeral, everything has got a symbol of alcohol with it. Everything. Not got a gram of coke. I don't think a lot of people realize until you stop drinking just how much subconsciously you are surrounded by it.
Yeah. Definitely. And it also highlights it for other people as well, that I think they become conscious of their alcohol consumption once you stop, because obviously they're looking at you not drinking, and then all of a sudden there's that self-awareness of how much they're drinking. And I think that's why some people don't like it. They don't like that mirror being turned back on themselves, even though we're not doing the ones turning the mirror.
Yeah.
They're the ones turning the mirror and obviously looking at themselves and how much they're drinking. And I think that's where a lot of the attitude does come from.
Yeah, you do notice that when you quit, some people just don't like being around you.
No.
Because, I mean, I used to be that person years ago. Well, you're boring now. I don't need to be around you because you're kind of holding up a mirror to my behaviour.
Yeah.
And I don't want to address that right now.
Yeah.
But, it took a few attempts, a lot of self-help books, which I find interesting. I was having this conversation. I have enough self-help books to build the foundations of a house. Most of them half read, because I think when you're actually ready, instead of reading it, you will actually listen to the words that are on the pages. When you actually listen, it will start taking effect. Until you're just reading, and you will not take it in. So I was eventually, I think it was in 2021, I did a 100-day challenge without alcohol. For me, it was always the first Saturday night, the second Saturday night. After that, it just seemed to be a lot better. But I got involved in a lot of podcasts, a lot of the quit literature books, and it just gave me like a new lease of life.
Yeah.
Because once I got past that initial phase and stopped worrying about what everybody else thought, and actually thought, I need to do this because this could be a slippery slope for me.
Yeah.
You know?
Could be.
It could be. And you know, it, and I heard a very good saying is, you don't always have to hit rock bottom, but if you can see it from where you are, yeah, you need to start making changes in your life.
Definitely. How long have you been sober for now?
11 months. So the first time I did it was 100 days. And I did the 100 days. I felt absolutely fantastic. But then I thought, well, I've done 100 days now. I'm sure it'll change my patterns. And within a week, I just, you know, having the odd glass of wine, thinking, oh, it's absolutely fine. Within 2 weeks, I was back in the exact same habits.
I did a similar thing. People were saying, oh, I think you've got a drinking problem. And I was like, no, I've not got a drinking problem. They're like, yeah, pretty sure that you have. And I was like, well, I can stop. And I stopped for 4 9 months. And then I was going away on holiday and I started drinking again. And the same thing happened. I started drinking. The size of drinks that I used to pour were just outrageous. So I reduced it down. And then within 2 weeks, I was back up to half a glass of vodka, half a glass of Coke. And obviously that was topped up with ice. And I put the ice in after I put the vodka in. And the same thing happened. In fact, I believe I drank more after I'd stopped than what I did before I'd stopped. Not to say that you shouldn't stop in the first place, but I definitely drank way more after I'd stopped than what I did before.
And I think as well, it depends on who's around you. I mean, mine wasn't too bad because I didn't have as many enablers around me, because if you're surrounded by friends and family who don't really drink at that time in your life, then you probably won't drink as much. You probably might drink more in secret, but when you go out, you won't get blackout drunk, all that kind of stuff. So my patterns were a little bit different at the time.
So were you blackout drunk as well?
If I would go out and drink with people that were in the same thing, then I would get absolutely paralytic. Like I say, that wasn't every day, it wasn't every week, but I would drink to get drunk. Yeah. I wouldn't have that stop button. I would want to carry on. Someone said, oh, we're stopping, we're going home. And I'm like, oh,
really?
and I do it, which is why people don't think you've got a problem. But if you put someone next to me who will carry on, then I will probably carry on with them.
So when did your sober journey start?
So after that 100 days, I started drinking and I started getting, it was coming to Christmas of 2021. And I had a temporary contract at work and I was starting to think, well, I'd left casinos. I don't think I'm quite on the same career path that I should have been. And I think at the back of my mind, I was starting to think, am I a bit of a failure here? This is not where I thought I would be when I left casinos after 25 years. I thought I'd be, you know, I was, big fish in a small pond kind of thing in the casino, and now I felt like a small fish in a big pond. Yeah. And it was a very big difference to me. And I started getting weird symptoms. I was getting this weird itch on my head and all these little strange things that were going on. And it's not until I realized that I was just suffering from anxiety. I'd never really had it before, but I'd never stopped drinking before. So I didn't understand what all these strange things called feelings and emotions. And obviously from that comes quite bad anxiety. So the first thing I actually did think, because I quit before, that's one thing that needs to go. I can't have alcohol and anxiety. This is a new ball game for me. So I said, right, okay, for a couple of months, certainly over the Christmas and New Year period, I'll stop. And I did, and I didn't enjoy it. The first time I quit, I loved it.
Was it easy the first time?
It was. Yeah. It was new. It was fresh. And this time, because I got anxiety, this was not enjoyable. Because I was thinking, why am I quitting? Why am I doing it? So
did you take anything for the anxiety? Your medication though?
No, for me, if you're not dealing with the problems, that can work with a lot of people, but that just wasn't an option for me. Yeah. I just didn't want to self-medicate when I've done most of that throughout my life in various different forms.
Yeah. So for me, when I suffered from anxiety, that's why I started drinking, or one of the reasons why I started drinking. So then that alleviated the anxiety, and then it did a 180 and bit me on the ass. I started creating anxiety, and because I was at anxiety for so many years, that then ended up leading to depression. I went on to amitriptyline. I always say, if it wasn't for the amitriptyline, I don't think I would have been able to have got sober. Yeah. It just put me back on track on the same level playing field as everybody else. I didn't have the anxiety. I wasn't depressed. And all of a sudden, I could see things clearly rather than drinking to try and get rid of these feelings and emotions. Yeah. I was able to take this tablet on a daily basis and put me on a level playing field, which was great for me. But then trying to come back off that, I stopped taking the tablet. I thought, I think I was on it for about a year and a half. And I thought, I can just stop taking this tablet. And I stopped taking it. And it was like, the only way I can describe it is, imagine if you built a wooden go-kart and your friend has just pushed you off the top of a really high hill. And then you're going down. And it's great to start off with. And then everything's shaking and vibrating. And then the wheels are coming off. And everything's just going mad. And it was literally like that until I took the tablet. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to have to go back onto the tablet. And I took the tablet and everything calmed back down again. And then I had to wean myself back off the tablet. So I get that part, that side of it.
Yeah, I was in a good position where I felt like I could cope with that. If I felt like I needed it, I would have gone to the doctors. But what I noticed is I was getting other symptoms and I'd not really put two and two together. The fact that I was 47 and it could be something else. But it is not until I actually started getting a hot flush that I thought, oh, because my energy was draining. My battery had gone from 100% to 30% and I was getting weird itching. And I just presumed this was also anxiety and I didn't realize I was actually going through the perimenopause and I'd started on it.
Right.
So I went to the doctors for that, but it was just for that. It wasn't for the anxiety. And that's when I realized I'd gone back to drinking. So I thought, well, I said I was just going to quit for a couple of months and I did. And I went back to it and straight away I thought, why am I doing this? Every time I quit, I go back to it, even though my life is better without it.
Yeah.
So I think, right, okay. And I think part of as well as doing it as saying to people, it's a challenge. I was sort of getting people around me to try and get used to the fact that I didn't drink because there was probably always used to seeing me with a bottle of wine. Every time I used to go visit my mum, the first thing would be clink, clink and the bottles of red wine every time. And it when I actually went over and they said, no, I'm not drinking tonight. You see, what? You always have a drink. And it's breaking those habits with other people as well because they don't know you really. Not drinking. Yeah. I didn't know myself not drinking or not having a spliff over the years. So that was the eye-opener is thinking, right, I need to actually do this and I need to do this for me and stop worrying about what everybody else thinks.
Yeah.
And if they say to me and tell myself this is not a challenge, but this next time when I quit now, I am going to do this A for me and B, I'm not going to give myself any time scale. If I feel that my life is going to be better by drinking alcohol, I will drink alcohol because I knew the answer to that would be never.
Yeah.
And 11 months later, there's still a never.
That, congratulations. That is amazing getting to 11 months. And that first 12 months is so difficult, I think, because it's everything is new. You've got to go through the birthdays. You've got to go through this. You've got to go through that. You've got to go through a job change. You've got Christmas. You've got to go on your first holiday. All those things that you have to do for the first time is really, really difficult. So congratulations to get to 11 months.
Thank you. It was good doing it for the 3 months because obviously the year before, I'd spent 5 years sober out of 12 months. So I'd got to go through all those experiences and realize actually I can do this. It's absolutely fine going on holiday without alcohol. It's not a problem. Just don't surround yourself with people where it is a big major issue.
Yeah.
I think that's where you do have to look at your life as thinking, am I surrounded by enablers? Am I not? Yeah. What changes have I got to make in my life? Because I think some people are. And I think when I've been in the past, if I've ever tried to quit and look back, you know, 5, 10 years ago, would never have happened because I was surrounded by too many drinkers.
Yeah, even for myself, the friends and family, not that they'd really intend it to be like that, but I do think they prefer to keep you in that situation because it's subconsciously, it's of a benefit to them. So I was always the life and soul of the party. Mm. So people would invite me around to be that person. When I stopped drinking, well, the invitation stopped.
Yeah.
You know, and also it's like sober people do complain from time to time about family members or friends not believing in that they can stop. It's like a New Year's resolution. I'm going to go to the gym every month, every day for the rest of the year. And your friends are like that, really?
Yeah.
And so they're not going to get on board with you when you first get sober because it's going to be that mentality. And it takes something like getting to a year point or doing your 3 months or stuff like that for the people then to start going, oh, okay, I can see that you're trying and you've got this far and that you're doing it. So did you get any support from anybody or anywhere?
No, I use a lot of podcasts. I'm not just saying this because I'm on one right now. But I did. And if you don't mind saying, the one that I used a lot was called Over the Influence.
Yeah.
And it's a northern woman. She's a radio presenter and she was on a bottle of wine every night and she decided to do it.
Not on the podcast.
No, not on the podcast. And it's a very funny podcast. And even the producer that was on it went alcohol free. And it's it's just a good laugh. And it just made me realize, actually, do you know what? There's a whole other world out there. Once you realize all the quick literature and the podcasts, there really is a huge sober tribe, an absolute huge sober tribe.
Yeah, because I said to you before we started recording as well, mind, and I always bring this up, is Angela Pugh with Addiction Unlimited. And I do not feel I would have got through the first 90 days if it wasn't for listening to that podcast, because I didn't need people telling me this, that and the other. I needed practical advice, which is what Angela gave me.
And
I didn't
sometimes, sometimes it is just going to be, do you know what? It's not all going to be unicorns and rainbows. Yeah. Some of it's going to be shit, because you're going to have to deal with feelings and emotions. And this is
some of it.
The reality. And, you know, even my therapist, which I'll talk about in a bit, was you're in your comfort shit zone. And that's what it's called. And you just need to just come out a little. And it's nice to hear other people's stories.
Yeah, definitely.
So that podcast was a big thing for me when I did my first 100 days, which was strange because the second time I did it, those same podcasts didn't work.
Yeah.
So I realized you just need to keep on working. What worked last time might not work this time. What worked last week might not work this week. So it's...
And again, I mean, that's a good lesson to learn as well. They always talk about this is your journey. It's not somebody else's journey. And again, you've done this journey twice and each time it's been different.
Yes. So when I finally quit, I'd actually, a friend on Facebook had posted about some iPass. I can't remember what it's called.
All right, okay.
It's the NHS referral therapy system.
Right, okay.
And they, you can refer yourself for free. You can do it without actually going through your doctors. You can do it through your doctors. And she posted because she was going through the perimenopause. She'd started working from home. There was a lot of things that were just changing in her life. She just wanted someone to speak to her about it. She'd posted it after she'd gone through all of it, raving about it. So I looked into it and I thought, actually, I'd quite like to do that. I think I'm ready for something like that. So I signed up for it, didn't think anything of it. Because if you suffer from anxiety, then you can do. So I signed up and left it. I then started doing some inner child work, which, you know, I'd read books on, read half of it, put it to one side. But I started doing some online breath work, and it's really deep breath, similar to what Wim Hof does, and it takes you to another level.
Right.
It really does, especially when you're holding your breath. But I did a course with a guy called Josh Connolly called Inner You. It cost me £100. It's the best £100 I've ever spent in my life, because you're also on there with an online community. You do these live breath work sessions, and when you do them, I mean, I've never sobbed like I have ever cried like that before. I used to get drunk to cry like that. To ever release any emotion when I was younger in my teen years.
I was a bawler as well.
When I was in my teen years, I would self-harm. Not huge, but thankfully I just got out of that pretty quick. But then I would just get drunk then I can cry, or then I can express emotion, because I can't do it without it. God forbid.
Yeah.
God forbid. So with this, and what was interesting is we do all the breath work, and people on the chat, or even sometimes they would talk on the video, they would actually say, this is what I went through. And it was so interesting. I'm thinking, oh, I didn't experience that when I did it. And I'm thinking, I think I need to open my mind a bit more. But it was, you know, you are never going to have much better mindfulness as when you stop breathing. Yeah. It sounds a very strange thing, but you're never going to get in tune with yourself until you actually stop breathing. It's a very strange experience.
Just as a side note, please carry on breathing after you've stopped breathing, just for a brief period. Don't want the listeners dying.
Oh, my God. But it was just the start of another journey, and it's very interesting because you grow up, because you're not speaking about your emotions or your feelings, you hold a lot of blame. A lot of shame. Shame is a big word that came up for me that shocked me.
Yeah.
How much shame I actually felt for myself growing up.
Do you feel shame for your addiction as well, to the drink issue?
Yes, shame for that. Shame for just not being able to express myself. Shame for, and I think maybe a lot of people might experience, if they've ever had divorced parents, shame for loving one parent more than the other. Especially, you know, if you're piggy in the middle kind of thing going on for a long time, it can be quite hard. And I think I just carried on. A lot of this, there was a lot of baggage there. Just carried it on and carried it on for years and years. And what was interesting is this year, it just all started unraveling, and it just all started making a lot more sense, because I realized this is the path that I want to be on. I don't want to be the one that pushes everything under the carpet anymore. This is the life that I want for myself. You've got one life. I intend to start living it, you know. So I did a lot of work on that. And then the therapy came up. It was 5 months later. I completely forgot about it. And that just helped validate a lot of things I've been working on. It really started putting the jigsaw together for me, and to stop beating myself up and to stop criticizing myself. Because the more I criticized myself, the more I criticized everyone around me, yeah, and took it out on other people. Because anytime I was feeling any anger, if you ever say to me, what emotions are you feeling? Anger. Yeah. I could not get my head around there's any other emotions, because I wouldn't accept any other emotions because I'd have to deal with them. So now I was actually having to start to deal with them. I found it really, really interesting, and I did get into it. But it was a scary thing. But yeah, I would recommend therapy for anybody. I really, really would.
Perfect. And we do actually offer counselling to group members. It is free. You get 50 minutes and 10 sessions. Sorry, 10 50-minute sessions for free. The link for that is a self-referral, and the link for that will be in the show notes. So going back to the challenges that you've had to deal with, what do you think the biggest challenges that you've had to deal with in your sobriety?
For me, it was definitely the emotions, the feelings, anxiety, the shame. Because this last time when I quit drinking, for me, quitting alcohol wasn't the hardest thing. It was stopping that becoming something else, like something that is accessible. Like, and I noticed I started eating more.
Yeah.
And it's not just eating more, it's that I zone out when I go to the fridge. I'm thinking that's what I used to do when I go and get a beer or a glass of wine, that zone out. And not having a little check-in with myself, a little word with myself, going, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
Have a think about this. You're not hungry. Are you bored?
Yeah.
You know what? But
that's
what
it comes down to. It's got the boredom into it as well, mainly. I did the same thing. So for the first 28 days, I said to myself, I'd allow myself to do absolutely anything and everything that I want to do, as long as I do not drink. And I ate, and I ate, and I ate, and I ate. I ate biscuits, I ate crisps,
it's
I ate
comforting
sweets.
Though, isn't it?
I put on two stone in 28 days. But again, after that 28 days, I did realise that I obviously had to stop.
Yeah.
And I did, thankfully, I did do that. But I do notice that now, again, because obviously when you are stressed, when you're coming from a long day at work and it's been stressful, yeah, obviously you can't drink and I can't do drugs. Well, it's not that I can't, I don't want to do it, but you still want to try and alleviate that anxiety and that stress throughout your life. So the first thing you do is go to the fridge, I suppose, or pick up a packet of crisps.
Yeah.
So, but it's, again, being conscious that I'm doing that and not taking it too far and allowing it to go too far.
I think journaling is good things for that, like to just noticing patterns. And even though I'll use journaling, I'll use breath work, I use a lot of things like this, I will dip in and out of it because I know it's there when I need it. Don't necessarily have to do it every day, but I know, especially with journaling, it's sometimes good to actually look back and think, I didn't even realize how dark a period I was in at that time, or actually how far I've come. Even in the last few years, I look at the last 4 or 5 years, and I think my life is very different from when I worked in the casino. Very, very different. I look back and think, actually, you know what? Give yourself a pat on the back. Sometimes it has been tough.
Yeah.
But you've actually accomplished quite a lot of things. Because I was even on a Teams call at work, and someone's like, oh, look at all the medals you've got on the wall. I was like, oh, yeah, they're just all my half marathon medals. So I'm really impressed. I'm thinking, I never even look at them anymore. Yeah. I don't even think about it. I just forget what I've actually accomplished because, you know, I'm quite an ambitious person, really. And you do easily forget and think, actually, do you know what? It's not about ego. Just give yourself a pat on the back and a well done. Talk to yourself nicely instead of criticizing yourself.
Yes, because the biggest and longest conversation you have is with yourself. Yeah. The same as a relationship. The longest relationship you're ever going to have is with yourself. So be nice, be kind to yourself.
Yeah, and I know therapies, what they did highlight is, start writing down some of the things. You know, if you stub your toe, if you do these little things throughout the day that get you a bit pissed off or annoyed, write down how you speak to yourself on what tone.
Yeah.
And I was absolutely appalled by some of the things that I was actually just saying and how aggressive I was talking to myself. And I thought, I wouldn't speak to other people like that.
No, exactly. If somebody spoke to you like that,
and
as well,
I could
you'd
speak
like that.
To people. Sometimes if I was pissed off, I could speak to people quite badly. Still, it was far, far worse what I was doing to myself. And I thought, how can you expect to have compassion and empathy and learn these things? It's something I've not been good at. How can you expect to have it to other people if you don't have it for yourself?
Yeah. And you can't let people in as well if you're being like that. I'm very similar, or would used to be very similar. I'd have very aggressive conversations with myself, but it's probably a bit schizophrenic conversations I was having. So actually having the conversation answering myself and having an argument, but in different voices. So anyway, moving on.
It's well high pitched.
Maybe it has a different accent as well. Anyway, we digress.
Yeah.
So how would your friends and family reacted to your sobriety then? Especially with it being your second time round as well.
Yeah, I think everyone kind of got used to it a lot more. What was interesting is the last week I was accepting a delivery for a friend next door. He said, oh, there's a nice bottle of alcohol-free wine in it for you. And it's just little things like that. And I was like, well, actually, no, it tastes like shit. I don't need that. You're okay. But it's just everybody embraces it. It's not because, oh, no, you're still not drinking. It's not. You get that for a bit, especially the first time, because it was part of challenges. But now everyone just accepts it. Says, that's just, I just don't drink anymore.
Yeah.
That's it. So it is just become the norm. And it takes, you've got to understand change. It's not just for you, it's for the people around you. So you've got to give other people time as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like I said before, it's like the New Year's resolutions, you know, to people, oh yeah, they'll never keep it up. And more often than not, people don't. So it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, really. So when you do finally decide to get sober and you are taking it serious, you know, you can't expect everybody to jump on board with you. It's going to take time for them to adjust. Just the same as it took time for you to decide that you're going to get sober as well. Yeah. Because obviously, even though it's an instant decision, that decision has taken a long time to come about. It wasn't straight away. Okay, so it's, do you think there is a direct correlation between the trauma that you sustained growing up being gay and your relationship with alcohol?
For me, I didn't really experience any trauma growing up gay. I hid it from certain aspects in my life, but I was in a very lucky position where it wasn't a major issue. Being gay in the 90s, it wasn't certainly as open, but I realised that even though I was growing up in Sheffield and the gay scene was very much in the steel industry area, you just keep away. You can have your bars and your clubs, you just keep away from everywhere. And then I had a night out in Manchester and it really
happened. Like, pull your bra off.
Oh my word, this is just different. You know, it was, you know, we had our own little area, our own little gay village, going down to Paradise Factory and Mantos, enjoying it in the rave culture. It was absolutely fantastic. So growing up, I was quite lucky in the fact that being gay wasn't an issue, so I didn't experience a lot of trauma around it. I did meet a lot of people that it affected, and you could see how it would affect people personally. But I was lucky in that sense. I think probably holding it into a certain aspect will have added to the baggage I was probably already just carrying and not dealing with feelings and emotions.
It's
so,
like a little carry-on case. It was
getting quite large by this point. But I suppose, especially when you're drinking drugs, especially in the 20s and experiencing all these new things, it's always exciting. But if you take certain drugs, you're quite chatty on them and talk about it.
I think you've heard me talk about when I was first took speed, and because I was so isolated and insular because of the trauma I sustained growing up, I wouldn't speak to anybody, and I didn't know how to have a conversation. I took speed for the first time. Jesus Christ, you couldn't shut me up.
Yeah. But especially in the gay community, we didn't have anything else. We didn't have any little circles. There was no meetup groups. There was nothing like that. You just went to a bar. Yeah. You were constantly surrounded by alcohol and drugs. That's all you had. There was no other community to meet like-minded people.
And I think that's where straight people probably don't understand is if you want to go and see another straight person, you just stick your head out the front door. If I want to go and see another gay person, I've got to get in the car, drive to my local.
Oh, Grindr. Well,
not round, do you? But before then, you'd have to get in your car and you'd have to drive to a large town or a large city and go to a gay bar. So you're immediately surrounded by drugs and alcohol. And I think that's obviously where a lot of people, especially gay people, their addiction starts, is because obviously they're in a vulnerable state to start off with. They've suffered trauma growing up being gay. And then the first place that you're going to see another gay person is in a gay bar. So you're going to have a drink in hand. You're going to see other people doing drugs, and it's just linear.
And you build up quite a tight-knit community there. We certainly did in the 90s in Manchester, because
that condone your behavior as well.
Exactly, because everyone's kind of doing the same thing. You know, not everybody is, but you're going out and partying all the time, so that's what you surround yourself for.
So how has your life changed for the better now that you've got sober?
I know this is quite a buzzword at the moment, but living your authentic self really, really does apply to me right now at this point in my life. It's not always been roses. It's been very up and down process. This is not to say that I've not had some absolutely fantastic, great times. Like I say, I've not always struggled with alcohol or drugs or anything like that in my life. I've always had a great time, great friends, great partnerships throughout the years. But I felt like there was always a little bit missing. There's always about 20% missing from my life. And it was just trying to find that within me. And I know it's an awful thing to say. It's like, start within. But finally, I got to the age of 47. I realized how true that is. Yeah. Until you fix that, you're not going to change who you are outward to other people. And I think I ought to just assess exactly how I was treating other people as well. Because I've noticed my... my relationship with sort of like my mum has improved. I think it was bad before, but I think I'm a little bit more compassionate and kinder, because I was just a little grumpy bugger a lot of the times. I really was. And I was not until I did the therapy, I realized I was just how selfish a person I was and how I looked into any friendship or relationship. I was always thinking, in the back of my mind, thinking, what am I getting out of this? Yeah. Because I need to feel that I'm whatever I'm missing at that time in my life, that 20%, you need to fill that. If you fill that, then I will be okay with anything else that's not been that doesn't match in our friendship. I think, okay, but you're going to fix what my need is right there. So if you treat me in a different way or the other, that's fine. I will, and it's a lot of it's to do with self-worth. Perfect. So
if we'd, you just in your 11 months of sobriety, what advice would you give to somebody that's just starting off on the sober journey? So obviously it's quite fresh with you.
Yeah.
What advice would you give that person? What advice would you give you from starting to being sober?
I would encourage to get a bit of a sober tribe, whether that's with podcasts or books. You will realise just
also the gay socials.
Also the gay socials.
Thank you, Jane.
You're welcome. I think getting into a community is absolutely vital. If you think you're going to quit something on willpower, you're going to think that you're missing something for the rest of your life. Get into the position. The only reason why I quit alcohol and I feel like I've been successful this time, I stopped putting it on a pedestal and stopped feeling like I was missing out. I had to change my subconscious into thinking, this is the path. If something bad goes up, and I go get a bottle of wine.
Yeah.
This happens, I go get some beer. And it was just changing those subconscious minds. And it's a well-worn path. You're not going to change it overnight. So don't think, oh, I don't feel great after 28 days. I'm going to start drinking again. You might not.
Yeah.
But just keep on trying and keep on with the different books, because something will click.
Yeah.
And it's about changing those patterns. And it's not overnight, but my God, is it worth it?
Yeah, definitely. But you're right with the fear of missing out, or FOMO, as we like to call it.
Yeah.
You know, that is the biggest way for people to, well, one of the biggest ways for people to relapse. You just feel like you're missing out. You know, like, it'll be so much easier to be drinking. But as we, again, so another buzzword or a buzz saying is play it forward.
Yes.
You know, it's think beyond that first drink, that first sip, and even for me, like the first bottle, you know, think beyond that, all the way through the evening to the early hours of the morning, to getting into bed and then waking up in the morning. Play that tape all the way through and then ask yourself, do I still want a drink? And if you do, then that's your decision. You know, nobody can stop you from doing that. But it's a really good indicator to obviously make you see.
Yeah, I don't romanticize it anymore. For a while, you get to the first summer and you think, oh, everyone's having the beers outside.
Yeah.
And then straight away, you say, you pay it forward to the morning and I'll walk my dogs past there and I'll see bits of sickle, bits of broken glass. And you think, probably how many people were probably crying outside that started off the night well, and you think it's not all fun and games. And then you actually think about it, right? Because you're thinking, no, it wouldn't have just been a couple of bottles of beer. You know, sometimes it might be, but sometimes, you know.
I think the biggest challenge I had with that was when I went on holiday for the first time. And I thought, I'll go away by myself because then there's no interference, and I can obviously get acclimatized by myself. And I got off the plane and went down the beachfront, and you can see the little restaurants and the little bars and everybody sat outside having the cocktails and the glasses of wine. And I didn't realize what I was doing, but I was actually staring at people and them drinking. And that was probably one of the biggest hurdles to try and get over was that, because you immediately think when you're on holiday, this is what I do. You know, you go to the airport, you start drinking, you get on the flights, you have your little bottles of alcohol, you get off the plane, you get changed, you go down to the beach and you start drinking. And I was like, this is really weird. You know, and it's not that I wanted to have a drink. It's just, I didn't know what to do myself, because that's what you do when you go on holiday. And again, I did find that challenging. And again, you can understand where people think, oh, fuck it, you know, I'm just going to go and do it.
You do, but you remember all of it.
Yeah.
You remember all of your holiday. It's like, when I started quitting drinking and went out to a gig, there was a woman close by to me, and she was flopping all over the place. She was absolutely paralytic.
She could have been anywhere.
Absolutely anywhere. And I'm thinking, you bought this ticket and has been looking forward to this gig this whole time, and you're not even going to remember even being in Manchester City Centre, let alone this gig.
<The event.
laughs> No, you don't even remember this day. It's a complete blank out. She was just flopping. And I thought, yeah, I really don't miss that. I actually come out and I can actually remember every single minute of this evening.
Yeah. So tell me about the women's walking group that you're involved with.
So this started a couple of years ago by a couple of women. They started an online walking group. There are quite a few walking groups, but this one just seems to just absolutely rock it with members. I think it was just a perfect time after COVID, really. People getting out and people getting into walking more. But yes, I organise a lot of walks. Most of mine involve a hill or two. they are proper hikes. And we do organise weekends away. And this is when I've realised that what gay women are like when they actually go out, it's they feel a lot more anxious.
Yeah.
But walking is actually quite a good thing, because you can be talking to one person, you can mingle quite a lot, and you're out in nature. It's a lot more relaxing.
Yeah.
So it's built up. We have weekends. I've got a lakes weekend next weekend, which I'm looking forward to.
Wonderful.
We've got a tough walk and a nice easy walk. So there is a huge mixture of walks. We even put on new starters. So if you want introductions to just a basic walk around a park, introductions to a hill. Vicky, one of our organisers, she does a lot of those. Just trying to get new members in, because we all understand women do struggle to come out to a lot of events, and not everybody wants a 12-mile hike up a hill with me. So,
and what's your group called?
The Lesbian and Bisexual Women's Walking Group Northwest.
That's bit a of mouthful. A mouthful.
It certainly is. You can find us on Meetup. There are a lot of members are there, but we've started adding a lot more social events on there. There's bowling, golf, all kinds of things. So if you're on that group, which a lot of women are, and you ever feel that, you know, you're a little bit nervous, just reach out to the host.
Perfect. And what women-only events have you got coming up with Sober Gay Socials? Obviously, you've just done the walk-ins yesterday, which was amazing.
So we're going to do a couple more coffee and strolls, because that seemed to unnerve a lot of people. It seemed to work quite well. I think the next one I'm looking for is just more of a city centre, maybe just even go around a couple of art galleries, that kind of thing, and just sit and have a little natter. I think that's what makes women more comfortable, I think. Got a looking at a theatre event called 30 and Out in June. And also a couple more. There's a woman called DJ Flourish, and she does a women only sober rave. It's not a gay rave, but looking at the next event for that, which would be quite interesting, because that was very successful that she did. And that was in Stockport. So there's a few events, always open to new ideas. But the main thing is to build up a little bit of a community with each other and comfortable with each other before we start. Because if you do things like bowling, people aren't always mixing with different lanes and stuff. So it's building that community and making women feel comfortable first.
Yeah. Okay, so guys, just and girls, well, mainly the women only, if you just keep your eyes peeled, the events will be posted on the Facebook page.
I'll try not post it to the men. He did not like a women only event.
Yes, they were a couple, but we're not like that as a group. We're very, very inclusive. Perfect. Well, thanks very much, Jane, for coming in and speaking on the show. It's been amazing listening to your sober journey and everything that you're doing for the group. We do appreciate it.
Thank you.
So if people would like to attend the events, please just go onto Facebook. Again, all the links will be in the show notes. Just a bit of an update as well. So we've got the Sober Sunday launch on the first Sunday of every month. Again, that's posted on the Facebook group. And then there is Spill the Tea, an alcohol-free event. That's on the 17th of March at 7:30 p.m. And that's held in the upstairs private lounge at Bar Pop on Canal Street. It's a social gathering where sober and sober curious people can meet. So we have a DJ playing dance classics along with a full range of alcohol-free drinks and live entertainment. The tickets are £10. That includes access into the event, inclusion into all the competitions held on the night, and a free drink from a selected range provided by Wise Alcohol-Free Spirits and Lucky Saints. The money raised from this event goes towards sober coaching for individual group members. Tickets are available on Eventbrite or by searching Spill the Tea, or you can click the link below in the show notes. You can also join the Sober Gay Socials Facebook group where all the events are posted, or you can follow us on Instagram. Just search Sober Gay Socials, or again, click the links in the show notes. If you would like to be a guest on the show, then please send an email to hello@sobergaysocials.org.uk. If you've enjoyed this episode, then please subscribe, like, and comment. But most importantly, spread the word by telling your friends. Thanks for listening, Sober Tribe, and I'll speak to you soon.